Hello. Before you start this episode of The Game Changers, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about our new documentary, Abby Ward, A Bump in the Road, which explores the challenges faced by professional female athletes and all working mothers. It follows the remarkable journey of an England rugby player as she battles back to the professional game just 17 weeks after the birth of her baby, and then on to secure her place in England's Six Nations squad for 2024. The documentary is free to watch in the UK on ITVX or globally on Rugby Pass TV. And don't forget that our other documentary, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport, is still available to watch on Netflix in the UK. Now it's time for the Game Changers. Hello and welcome to the Game Changers podcast, where you'll be hearing from trailblazing, fearless women in sport. I'm Sue Anstis, and in this episode, it's rugby legend Maggie Alfonsi, MBE. Few players in recent times have had such an impact on the world stage as this England flanker and World Cup winner. Now retired from the game, Maggie talks so passionately about her playing career and her future leadership aspirations. Rugby is now one of the fastest growing sports for women in the UK, but that wasn't the case when Maggie started playing. I began by asking her if she could remember the first time she'd picked up a rugby ball.
Yes, I can remember. So I picked up the rugby ball officially when I was around 13, 14 years old, down at my local rugby club, Saracens. But I guess the reason why it all came about was because my behaviour at school was really bad. My PE teacher at the time, a lady called Lisa Burgess, who was the captain of the Welsh women's rugby side, suggested I go to my local rugby club because my behaviour was so bad and pick up this sport because it might turn me around, change me to a better person. And I listened to her. I went to my local club. So when I picked up that rugby ball for the first time, I was quite baffled by it because I came from North London. Rugby at the time wasn't very popular. Football was pretty much the dominant sport. So this ball, full stop, was quite novel to me.
The shape, just the
way it looked and how it moved. I mean, why would anyone want to pass it backwards? And at school, we didn't play rugby. You know, rugby was for the boys, but the boys still didn't really like rugby because, again, football was the main sport. So rugby I was really unaware of. So to go to my local rugby club, pick up the ball, make a pass, make a tackle, I fell in love with it. You know, it was a sport that really did fit my characteristics, i.e., you know, I was big, I was strong, and I sort of had probably an aggressive behaviour back then, and it really worked.
Yeah,
and also it helped control my attitude and my behaviour because I was surrounded by other people who were. Equally wanting to be quite physical and be quite strong, but also very respectful. So yeah, I found a sport that I guess suited my nature.
It's interesting. I obviously remember Lisa Burgess myself, Bird from Loughborough, many, many years ago. But fantastic to hear that a teacher made such a difference to you, you know, at that key point in your life there as well.
Yeah, she was significant. I mean, I talk about her mainly because she was the one who sort of directed me to the rugby. And there was another individual called Miss Walker at the time. And she pretty much managed to maintain my leadership behaviour because she gave me that direction on how to be responsible for my actions. And I guess knowing where I want to go in my career. So both those two teachers had a significant impact in my life. But I guess Lisa Burgess Bird directed me down that rugby path.
And what was the setup like at Saracens at the time?
Yeah, so very thankfully at Saracens they had a girls section, which not a lot of rugby clubs did. Not a lot of rugby clubs had women's sections. So to go to Saracens and know that they had a first team and a second team women's team, and they had it wasn't an under 16s or an under 18s team. It was basically just a girls setup. And our coach at the time, Katie Ball, who a fantastic individual, who also did a bit of rowing and went to the Olympics. I can't remember what year it was,
but you do.
Yeah, in her spare time. She was basically our coach at the time, and it was great. We had about 12 girls playing we weren't all experts at the sport, but we were just gradually learning through Katie Ball. And I think going down to the club, seeing these girls who are quite similar to me and from real diverse backgrounds really appealed to me. And they made me feel incredibly welcomed. And also I saw women, you know, I saw the girls we trained on a earlier time to the women. So when we finished training, I'd see the women after and I'd be like, wow, that's my, you know, I'm hoping that I'll one day be like that. And I would see Bird every now and again come to training. So it was nice to be part of a club where I could be around peers who are similar to me, but then also see the individuals that I hope to aspire to be like.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about role models. So, you know, we talk a lot about kind of role models, and I know my daughter's still talks about meeting you at the Women's Sport Trust Awards those years ago. So you've obviously inspired many girls. But in terms of your role models, did you have role models at that time?
So I guess growing up, I probably would say the role model that I sort of looked at was Denise Lewis. You know, back in 2000 when she won the gold medal at the Sydney Games, it was great to see someone, I guess, who again looked and came from a similar background to me. I know she's I think it's Wolverhampton or Birmingham based, that's where she sort of originated from. And I mean, myself as well, like I came from North London and Edmonton, and quite a challenging background. But to see someone of her, I guess, level go that far from where she came from and then be a profile for many other women, I guess women of colour in particular, I looked up to her significantly. I still do.
Does she know that? Have you told her? She might know now. She hears this.
I haven't actually. I haven't told her. What's funny is like every now and again I get mistaken for her. So it's quite a nice thing to know that someone out there thinks that I look like her. But I haven't told her. I just think it's nice to know that there's someone out there who is still paving the way. You know, she paved the way for a lot of female athletes. You know, we talk about the likes of Jessica Ennis-Hill being brilliant at what she does, Catherine Granger as well. But I genuinely believe Denise Lewis was the starting female role model for us because she, I think at the time, was the only Brit. Female Brit to win a gold medal in 2000 in athletics. So I just think she's someone who sort of set the mould for many female athletes, and now many of us look up to her.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And you then be the role models in the future. And how does that feel, I guess, to you, knowing that you are a kind of role model and inspiring women and girls?
Probably similar to Denise Lewis. You don't think that you are doing it. You know, you don't set out to be role model. If anything, you just set out to be the best that you can be, the best version of you, and hope that others will follow in your footpath. And that's what I do, I guess. I go out, I played my rugby, and I played it to the best of my capability, and not let anyone stop me, regardless of what their perceptions may be. So being a female, I wasn't going to let that stop me. Being from an ethnic minority, I wasn't going to let that stop me. Or come from a low social economic background, I wasn't going to let that stop me. And I think what's great is that I've been successful on that main stage. And now people from that sort of background who maybe have similar, I guess, starting points to me are now thinking, do you know what? I can totally do that. Yeah. And if anything, I can exceed what she's achieved. And that, for me, is brilliant. Yeah. And now when I do media stuff, I keep thinking the same thing. I apply that same principle as I was as an athlete, is I'm not going to let anyone stop me, regardless of the perceptions that people have of me. And hopefully through you just doing what you do, it leads others to follow you.
And it sounds like you were super committed in terms of playing and training as your career then developed. So at what point do you think you recognised you had real potential to go on and play on a larger stage, as it were?
Yeah, it's funny. Even I look back now and I think it was that imposter syndrome. Like, I never thought at any stage I was going to be successful and make it to play for England. You know, I just played my sport. I absolutely loved it. I enjoyed the fact that I was good at tackling and that I was able to work with other team members and help them look good as well. So I loved that feeling. So I never really understood or accepted that I would make it to be very successful. But when I finally got there, I started to really believe it. Yeah. You know, it's that fake it till you make it sort of feeling where, right, okay, I might get there. Okay, I finally got there. Now I've got to believe that I am an incredibly good athlete. And I guess not until I retired did I really stop and look back and think, I was all right. I wasn't too bad.
And what was it? I guess getting that first England cap. At what point do you think you thought, not I've made it, but, you know, you could take a moment to recognise?
So my first England cap was way back in 2003, and I was out in Canada, and I scored my first try for England against USA. Yeah, God, it feels so long ago. against USA, and that year was an incredible year because the men had won the men's rugby World Cup. So to get my first cap, it felt like that year was an amazing year. Not because of the men's World Cup, but because of me, obviously. Yeah. So even to this day, I think scoring that try, having that experience, you know, I still felt almost like a naive rugby player because I was surrounded by some...
How old were you when you got your first cap?
I was 19 years old and I was surrounded by some fantastic legends. You know, for me at the time, a lady called Paula George, Karen Andrews, Claire Frost, Helen Clayton, some brilliant, fantastic role models for me in the world of rugby. I got to play alongside them. So I didn't feel like I had to worry, but I did feel like I was the young one in the group. But it was an amazing experience and one I really do treasure.
Jumping forward then to that extraordinary World Cup win in 2014, obviously there have been three World Cups before that where you'd lost in the semi-finals, which must have been hugely painful for the team. How many of those had you played in the previous?
Thanks for reminding me. I played in two of the World Cups beforehand. So in 2006 out in Canada against silver, and then 2010 in England at the Harlequin Stoop, and we got silver there. So yeah, I played in two of those World Cups, and each and every single one of them were quite painful to experience, but drove me on for another 4 years.
How do you deal with it? How, as a team and as an individual? Because I guess that is seen as the pinnacle of, you know, whether it's Six Nations or the World Cup. But how did you deal with that in the intervening years? You know, for it to happen twice before.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the good bit in a minute.
Yeah,
but
just interesting. Well, in 2006, I guess I was a young one in the team. I was 22 years old. And that was my first Rugby World Cup. I truly believe that we were capable of winning that World Cup. I still believe that we were capable of winning that World Cup. And so when we lost it, I think I just felt quite angry. Not at my team. I just felt angry the fact that I knew that we had it in our grasp and we probably weren't able to get over the line. So if anything, what it did do was, for me as an individual, I guess it made me more driven and more focused. And also at that time, my team had quite a lot of experienced players. So post that World Cup in 2006, a lot of the team retired. So I became one of the senior players going into 2010. So it was painful to experience that loss in 2006, but it was a very good learning experience for myself as an individual and for some of those younger players in the team. 2010, I think, was probably the most painful of all the experiences because, I guess, it was another 4 years. There was a lot of build-up around women's rugby.
Yeah, you were at home.
And we had a good crowd. So back then, actually, that was a record crowd for women's rugby in England. I think we had just under 14,000 people come to watch that game. Again, it was against New Zealand, so, you know, one of the biggest nations. The score was 10-all, I think, into the final, like 5 minutes, and then we lost it by 3 points. So, I look at that game as, oh, God, we had it in our grasp and we let it go. And so after that final, it wasn't necessarily anger, it was almost now revenge. So I think, and what was great, that team, we pretty much stayed together.
So only
a couple or three players retired, but that team was able to go on a journey for another 4 years, which is what I think allowed us to win it in 2014.
Okay, that was my next question. But I guess, what do you think was different in 2014 that made that happen? It was the unity and the...
It was the emotional connection. You know, I've forgotten the person's name, but they talk a lot about the why, you know, and I think over the...
Stephen Sinnott, isn't it? I just gave the book to someone this afternoon, actually. I've got a stash in my office that I give out.
Because it is a fantastic theory around...
Simon Sinnott.
Understanding the why. So it was understanding the team why, but more importantly, it was about understanding each and every individual's why. You know, why do we want to win a World Cup? Why do we want to play for England? And I think I as an individual learnt more about the people in my team. I had this emotional connection that was all about wanting to win a World Cup for them, and not really about winning it for yourself as an individual.
And was that someone, was there a psychologist or someone that worked with you on that in the intervening time?
Yeah, there was a psychologist who came on board, and she sort of, I think we had it already, we just needed someone just to bring it out. So she was quite significant going into the last few, I'd say probably the last week of the tournament, because we started to bring that to the forefront. I just think, not until you know your actual reasons why you're there and everyone else's reasons why they're there, do you start to go, okay, that's why I want to win the World Cup. It's not about you know, your own profile. It's not about making lots of money. It's not about that.
Well, suddenly you've got 15 different reasons. You know, yeah. It's yours and other reasons.
It's about
too.
The people you actually are considering to be your family,
yeah.
And that you're instilling your future in. So that was huge for us. That was absolutely probably the main reason why I won it. You know, understanding the why, having that psychologist come in to sort of steer us in that right direction. Yeah. And then realising it was about a team. It was a team focus, not an individual focus.
And so winning,
yeah,
amazing. As you sit here now today, you know, 5 years on,
yeah.
Can you remember how you felt at the time? That
yeah, seems so long ago, if I'm honest. I felt younger, that's what I felt. Well, basically what I felt personally was relief. Mm. because I guess to be part of the team over that, 12-year period and lose two World Cup finals was quite tiresome.
I guess knowing that people were going to retire as well, that's the piece, is that extra pressure, isn't it? That was the...
That's exactly the case. It was almost like we had to win this. That, you know, losing wasn't an option, because I knew if we had lost that final, it starts again. You know, those who are Olympic athletes know what it's like. You start again, and it's quite hard work. And especially a lot of the experienced players would have stepped away. Lots of young players, and if I'm honest, a cycle of winning a World Cup takes about 8 years, I'd say, 8 to 12 years. You know, yeah, yeah. And we saw that with our England women's team. They lost the World Cup in 2017, and I generally think they'll go on to be successful in the next World Cup, because it takes time to build a team. Yeah. You can't just do it in 4 years. I personally believe anyway. So I think winning that World Cup in 2014 was the right time. And our team was very close, but yeah, it was relief, yeah. Rather than you know, just celebration.
Or, yeah,
it was like, actually, God, we've finally done it, and that's so good. And even after the final, and the last thing I was thinking about was getting incredibly drunk. It was actually all about, you know, there's some good key people in my life who are out there, out in France with us, and I just wanted to say thank you to them, and thank you to my teammates, and then get to bed. that's basically it, because the job
given
has done.
All, haven't you? Yeah. Given you all. And do you think if you hadn't won, would you have continued on to play for another cycle, do you think?
I would like to have. I think there's two things that probably would have influenced my decision. So prior to that final anyway, I didn't announce that I was going to retire, but I remember collecting my shirt and I was crying anyway prior to that final,
yeah.
And I knew that I was going to step down,
yeah.
Because once I finished the World Cup and we won it, I had announced my retirement. So I guess the two things that were influencing my decision would have been, if we'd won it, I would try to hang around, but I knew that the best of my rugby days was pretty much over anyway. And I'm a big believer, you know, it's not about me, it's about making sure that the next players come through and
how
have that experience.
You, when you were...
So I was 30 years old,
right.
And and it wasn't about me. There's some other younger players coming through. You know, I look at, you know, Miley Packer in particular, you know, players like that, who actually it's about letting them have their moment.
That's a very generous. I hadn't really thought about that time,
yeah.
But I guess people that go on and play and play and play, but actually is allowing the space for others to come and have their time in the sunshine. And
yeah, because prior to me, a lady called Helen Clayton, we call Rob, you know, she was the dominant number seven before I got that shirt. And then I remember when I retired, she said to me, you know, it's the changing of the guards,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's now for me to step away and for you to have your moment. And and I really remember that very clearly.
Okay.
So that's why when I you know, stepped away, it's I mean, Miley Packer was always going to be successful anyway. There's many other number sevens,
yeah.
And back rows who are doing well. But really, I've had my moment.
It's on your terms as well,
yeah,
isn't it? You're not
exactly.
Going out through injury or being deselected or
exactly,
something like that.
Yeah.
You're in control. You said there were two things.
Basically, it would have been basically it's changing the guard, so wanting to let others have the opportunity. But also, knowing what elite coaches are like, they're thinking about the next cycle.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, would I be a good player in 4 years' time? I doubt it. So I think the coaches at the time would have also enforced that decision on me. And I guess the third thing would have been is I had quite a bad knee problem anyway. And I remember talking to the surgeon who worked on my knee And I remember him saying to me, you've got one more good year left in that knee. And that took me up to the World Cup. So once the World Cup was over, I played for another year at club rugby, but I struggled because my knee wasn't that at its very best, really. So I was really fortunate. The timing of the World Cup come at the right time, you know, in the sense that I could step away. I wasn't getting any younger, but my knee had enough in it to be the best that it could be.
Yeah. And I guess in terms of other sports in your history, and I know that you dabbled a bit in terms of some athletics and shot put, and had you played other sports? Had you clearly athletics, but other team sports or anything else?
So football was a big thing for me. So I guess growing up in North London, not too far from Tottenham, you know, and Arsenal actually, you had to basically be interested in the round ball. So I absolutely love football. I played it at playtime at school with the boys, and not all of the girls would play. And I played for our school team, and I took up a little bit of it at my local club, which was, I think, Enfield FC.
So why rugby and not football, do you think?
Yeah, I guess if I'm probably... deep down inside me, I saw football as being a sport that everyone played it, and I wanted something completely different.
Yeah, absolutely, I think many rugby players feel that is, you know, I guess as it gets more popular, that almost becomes more of a challenge. But I know my daughter likes the fact that other people at school don't play it.
Yeah, that's exactly. I saw it as a unique, novel thing which people were intrigued by.
Yeah.
Where if I said I played football, I think people just were like, oh yeah, I play it as well, or they'll have perceptions of me playing football, or they'll impose their opinions on me, which I really wasn't interested in. Where rugby was so different, they're like, wow,
they
you play
comment, yeah.
Yeah, they're like, what's that like? Oh, you must be hard when you play, you know, you're a tough person to play that sport.
Proud of those bruises on the Monday back at school.
So I loved it, and that's what sort of drove me on it. And even still to this day, you know, the rugby game is getting popular within women and girls, which is great. And I think it's unfortunately not there where football is in terms of popularity and profile, but it's a sport that still is, I think, unique.
Yeah.
It's different. It brings interesting values, and I think it instills confidence, I think, in people's body images and also their attitude to life, I think. So rugby did that for me, and I think what's great, it's doing that for many other younger girls and women.
And are you still involved at Saracens now?
I was on their Saracens Women's Board. I've now stepped away from it, but I'm now an avid, passionate supporter.
Saracens for life.
And that's the thing, I think I probably wanted to step away from it to just love it for what it's worth, and you know, I'm so proud and pleased of what the women's team
it's
has become now.
Season. I know I was asking you about that actually.
Yeah.
So I guess how does it feel? I guess watching them from the sidelines now and not being out there.
Oh look, I'm gutted. I'm not part of that program, that squad, because of what they're achieving. But what I'm really pleased about is that I was part of the process. Like there's been many women before me who were part of the process that helped our Saracens women's team at the time be successful. So I look at the team with fond memories, and I'm just incredibly proud of what the first team, the second team has achieved, and what the men's team are achieving. You know, I remember when they were back down at Bramley Road, you know, amateur setup, and now, you know, the flourishing, winning European premierships, you name it. As a club, I'm so lucky that my first club was Saracens.
And it's amazing, you were there the whole... I mean, people do move to different clubs and clubs change, but you've been loyal, and they've been loyal to you too.
As people say, you know, if you cut me, I'd bleed red and black, you know, just because it's been a club that has supported
you're
me.
In red and black today, aren't you? Like Saracens colours.
I just wanted to really get that across. But it's been a club that supported me as a family, you know. I've had some challenging times throughout my life, and what was nice is that they've always been there.
Yeah.
And I like to think that even now, as a supporter and as one of the old girls, as we say, if any of the young girls experiencing challenges or need help in terms of career, you know, there's many of us old girls who have very good jobs who can help support them. So I like to think that we have that club attitude.
And the success of the team at the moment, obviously they won the Tyrrells Premiership again. So where do you see, why do you think the difference that they're doing at Saracens versus others that are in that Premiership?
Yeah. So I'd say Saracens and Harlequins are probably two of the strongest teams in the Premiership, with regards to what they do off the pitch. So I would say one, they've got an incredibly good connection with their men's setup. So if I look at Saracens, their relationship with the men's organisation is perfect. Nigel Ray is a huge supporter of the women's section. They've also got, you know, in terms of PR, they're aligned there, and also in coaching. So I think sometimes Alex Anderson does a bit of work with the women's setup. So that's, I mean, that's incredible, yeah, to have that level of support. And the second thing I'd say, what the Saracens Women have created is almost that level of, I think you mentioned it with regards to me, club loyalty. Mm. So you've got players who generally want to be there. They're not just coming in because of the profile, because they're winning, and then they're dipping out and finding another good club. You've got players who've been at that club for probably quite a while now, or have been there since when we weren't winning.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if I, you know, Sonia Green is a good example. She's been there since the club started, I'd imagine. But it's great to have players like that who are just proper club players. Not all of them play for England yet. We have got a good amount of England players, but they were Saracens before they became English England players. So it's great to see that the fact that the club's got a very good loyal setup. And then I think the other thing I'd probably say is just we've got a professional setup, in the sense that we've got our director of women's rugby, Laura Eddy, who's amazing what she does. And then we've got a really good coaching foundation. Mm. You know, previously we had Robert Kane, who was our head coach. Now Alex Osprey's become the head coach, but he's supported by I think three or four other really good coaches. So it's that professional setup. Even though it's still effectively amateur, they've got this, it looks like a professional programme, which is what I think appeals to a lot of people.
You're now a spectator and watching from the sides. How, in terms of just going back to that transition of your no longer being an international rugby player as a persona, how was that for you in terms of that transition in 2014 to life?
Incredibly hard. Be openly honest, it's still hard now when you think about it. So I guess I retired in 2014 from international rugby. I was working for a big charity called the Youth Sport Trust, and I was an athlete mentor manager there. So what was good is I had a full-time job already. Yeah. But what was tough was realising that the identity of being an athlete was sort of removed from me, and I became 100% a working person. Mm-hmm. And I guess I didn't really appreciate the challenges that would create.
Had you been alerted to that before that happened, do you think? Or
yeah, I knew of it, really. Right. You know, every athlete knows about it. And
you just don't think about it in kind of in the future.
It's true, and it's probably the biggest mistake. You know, always prepare yourself for that life after. I even did my master's dissertation on the life after sport, because it's important to recognise that athletes know it's coming. They don't necessarily take ownership of it. And I think that was the biggest thing for me. I probably wish I'd taken more ownership over that transitional period. Yeah. By that, I mean, you know, increasing my networks of key people in businesses and actually going out to meet them and identifying opportunities that I could do to help build my skill level. And doing qualifications is key. I think that's always sort of part of developing your CV. But I think to really make you stand out and be a little bit different, it's about building those relationships. And that's one thing I would say to people now. Relationships are key. People don't just hire you for what skills you have. People hire you because they like you. And I that's what I do in my job now. You know, when I'm hiring people, it's actually, have I got that relationship with them? Would they work well in this team? Would they have a good relationship with other people on that team? And people keep saying to me, it's about like a rowing boat. It's about filling that rowing boat and making sure that they all work together to be successful. So yeah, I think relationships are key. Building that network. But anyway, yeah, sorry, what I was trying to say is that I found it incredibly hard, because the network that I did have, which was obviously a coaches and a performance psychologist and all of that, that had just gone. And I was on a and I was on my own, and I knew I was going to be on my own, but you don't really realize how tough it's going to be. So I quickly built a new team. You know, it was all about, I tried to find a new sport, so I tried to get back into athletics. I tried to identify a physio, I tried to identify a coach. I created my team me, I guess, but the reality was it just didn't work. And over time, I've now formulated a proper team that I feel works for me and the life that I live now. And it took a while to find the job that worked for me. So I left the Youth Sport Trust, I went into media, and I still do my media now, but I realised that I can't And I don't want to just live off media. No. I want to have one role that sort of gives me stability. And thankfully, and through the relationships that I have with Vitality, I now am a director at the company. So that gives me that real level of stability. And then the media almost supplements it and gives me a sporting focus. The work that I do with Vitality gives me, I guess,
sense
a corporate
purpose, yeah, sense of purpose. And in terms of the media, so I guess amazing that you know, be a Telegraph columnist now. And I guess being that first female sports pundit to comment on men's rugby through ITV, how did that feel for you at the time? Did you feel, again, you were breaking new ground there?
Yeah, I have to admit, I did feel like a weight on my shoulders when I first...
The whole of womanhood watching you there.
God, I was like, I mean, it was the first game, it was France versus Romania in the 2015 Men's Rugby World Cup, and I just remember thinking, God, I don't want to make a mistake. That's all it was. I know rugby inside out, but I just don't want to make a mistake.
It's that extra pressure, isn't it? I was going to ask you about Alex Scott, you know, that actually females doing an amazing job as pundits, but so much more pressure and focus on them because they're females and people aren't used to them. So you obviously felt that too at the time.
I did, yeah. I mean, it was quite funny. Like, look, I didn't make a big deal of it at the time. I didn't, you know, didn't write on Twitter or anything like that. I was just like doing this game, and that was it, basically. Yeah. And it was so interesting, the amount of comments I had post that. People just saw it as, that is very different. You know, never seen a woman talk about rugby for a men's World Cup.
And was there a negative?
What I can remember was there were people were very... I'm just unsure of it, really, because if I think about it, up to that point, there had not been any women. There had been women being reporters.
Yeah, like Hazel Irvine and the sports.
Yeah, and had done an amazing job, like Gabby Logan's. Yeah. They had always been there, but there had not been women in the position of...
The pundit.
Saying your expertise on the sport. So for me to do it was quite groundbreaking. I was alongside Sean Fitzpatrick, you know, former New Zealand men's rugby captain. So that, I mean, I'm in awe of him. He's a legend. But what was great is that he was so relaxed and didn't even see anything different. He was like, we're going to chat about rugby and that's about it. So I felt incredibly relaxed and I absolutely loved the moment and did the rest of the World Cup. I was in the studio, then pitch side all the way up until the final, the men's final. So I'd never been, again, a woman talking on the men's game in that sense. So I absolutely loved it. And after that, and now it's part of what I do. And I guess when I first started, and probably similar to Alex Scott and then many other women who are now breaking that barrier, when I first started, I guess I got a lot of negative comments about, you know, being a woman talking about men's sport. And no one really criticised my content. It was more about just being a woman.
Just being a woman, criticise you for that. Because actually what you're saying is really good.
Exactly. And actually, now what's good is I'd rather have a debate. You know, now I get people who would say I agree or disagree. And I'm like, that's fine. Yeah. I'd rather you agree or disagree with what I'm saying, because then we can have a debate.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about, okay, I disagree that him or her ran that line. You know, that's fine. That's a discussion. And sport and anything we talk about, like politics, should be about a debate. But when you're commenting and saying that I shouldn't know something about the sport because of your gender, that's when I'm like, what discussion or debate are we going to have there? Because it's pointless. So now the comments are a bit more, you know, it's more open and constructive, and actually people are more positive and supportive. I don't want people to support me just because I'm a woman.
No.
I want people to support me because actually what my content is correct.
And I guess you should be proud, you know, Nolly was at the weekend on the Channel 4, so sort of setting that path for other women to go out and comment and be accepted in that way too.
Yeah, I mean, what's great is that we've got, it's just now growing. The only challenge that we have in the world of probably more media is the fact that there's less roles for women.
Yeah.
So the challenge you have is that there's more women coming out and now finally getting opportunities, and then there's less opportunities in terms of positions for those people. So where obviously if you look at probably men's sport, there's you know, lots of men can get into various different roles where you find maybe on a sporting panel there might be one woman.
Yeah, we can change that. We're on a mission, aren't we?
Totally,
we are half the population, aren't we, after all?
Yes, we are. And what's great is there's more of us out there. So I'm just really pleased that many of us are breaking the barrier, not just in rugby, but in other sports like, you know, football, hockey, you name it, and cricket.
And where do you see, cricket, love you, Ebony, where do you see that going in the future? Do you feel more confident now to probably where you were when you first had the opportunity?
Yeah, definitely. I think I see it growing. I see, you know, hopefully we'll see more women, not just in media roles, as in front of the camera, but see more of them behind the camera. Yeah, producers, directors, camera women. Like, you know, people don't recognise that there's not a lot of women out there, you know, holding the cameras as well. And I, every time I see a couple, I'm like, yes, you keep going. You know, I want more of you out there. So but that's
what that role modelling, isn't it? It's exactly the same as we talked to in sport. It's actually the more that people see it and see it's a goal, that something that they could do in the future.
Yeah, definitely. So that's what I hope to see in the future. Yeah. And so that's my goal. I think my future goal is that I'd probably step away from media in the future, but be more of a leader in terms of, you know, my goal and my dream is to be, you know, hopefully the next, you know, Sally Mundane. You know, I want to be a CEO of a sporting organisation.
Okay, cool.
And a woman of colour in that position, because obviously there's, if I look at diversity, there's not much of that. And I want to be one of those women who are flying the flag or doing some amazing stuff, and who knows, one day be the president or the CEO of the RFU. That would be absolutely amazing.
I love this.
So
fantastic. So that's
where my current aspirations and goals are. You know, I look at Sue Day, for example, you know, CFO for the RFU, which is fantastic, and I want to be in a position where I can be on that, who knows, one day exec team and be fronting that up. So that's what I'm currently working towards right now, and media is great because it allows you to understand the game from a different perspective, but also maintain that profile.
So in terms of I guess the girls got their professional contracts this year, which is fantastic news. How did you feel about that, looking back? Would you have liked that to have been a full-time professional athlete, do you think, or actually would that have made the transition out of sport even harder because you wouldn't have had a kind of career path running alongside?
It's such an interesting question, because if I was in the sport now, I'd say yes, I would love to have had a professional contract, because I know what it was like to try and balance up one job and try and be the best that I could be in that professional job, and then at the same time trying to develop my skills and ability to be the best I can be as an athlete. So if I was still in the sport, I'd say, oh my god, I wish I had the professional contract. Now I'm out of the sport, I'd probably say I guess it's important to an extent that athletes are able to develop their career whilst being an athlete. And I guess the challenge you have of having a professional contract is athletes unfortunately are unable to do that, or maybe lose sight of that. So I guess I've always fought for professional contracts for the female athletes, because it's the right thing to do. You know, if the men have got it, the women should have it. I will never stop fighting for that. And what's great is that the women have got that. Well, the England women have got it. We still need across the world other women to get it. I guess what I want, though, is to make sure that as part of their contracts and as part of their development, they are improving and building their career. Because if we look at the men's setup, a lot of them are getting professional contracts younger and younger and younger. Yeah. And the women at the moment, they're you know, they're getting it slightly a little bit later in their career. But what's going to happen is as they get, you know, as women's rugby gets more professional, you'll start to see more women get contracts at a younger age. And their career or their education might not have developed at that time. So I think it's really important that we are supporting our athletes who become professional to develop their career, to develop their skills and their abilities. So when they do transition out, because when they come out, there's going to be, you know, all of those women who've had professional careers are going to have the same level of expertise.
Absolutely.
And opportunities become less and less and less.
That's a fantastic point. That is so important, isn't it, for the future of the
It is.
Sports.
We need to. We need, and it's also a duty of care. We need to be protecting our athletes, that when they do transition over, that we are giving them skills that they can fit into the reality of civilian life, because civilian life looks at athletes different to you know, someone who's been in that position. Let's say a HR director, they've been in that position for 10-15 years. An athlete cannot just walk into that role unless they've got their expertise. So we need to be able to help support them to get those skills.
And looking girls coming through playing rugby now and aspiring, what advice would you give to somebody that's kind of almost aware you were, you met Lisa Burgess, or a bit further on, what would be the kind of couple of key points you might say to someone on their career path now getting started?
I would say, one, be curious. You know, you do not know everything, so open your mind to learning. So for me, when I was I guess that youngster trying to get into the sport, or developing in the sport, I tapped into the expertise and knowledge of those senior players who are currently there. I tapped into the knowledge of the coaches. I would take ownership of my own development. I did not let the coaches dictate my learning. You know, I would make contact with the coaches and say, right, I need to work on this. Can you come and see me, in terms of my England coaches? I went and observed men's and women's teams and their coaching as well. I would throw myself into environments that were a little bit uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I say it all the time, it's about being comfortable, being uncomfortable. So I would stretch myself on a regular basis. So when I was on the pitch, it was about being the best version of me. Yeah, not just being an okay player.
And comfortable and yeah. Know what you can do. Yeah.
And I still remember to this day, like my old England coach, Jeff Richards, who was an Australian and a really good mindset he had. He was like, it's not about being the best player in England, it's about being the best player in the world. And that's how I guess I approach my life today. It's not about being, you know, a good leader in this country or a good leader in the company that you're in. It's about being the best leader. Like, how are you going to be the yeah. best leader? And for what I would say to a young person getting into sport is be curious, learn from everyone, stretch yourself and challenge yourself on a regular basis. I would also say set your goals. I think that's very key. I think I live by that now. I always have goals and work and what I'm working towards, and I call them small wins. You know, make sure you have those little goals where you're like, oh, awesome, I achieved that this week, mm-hmm. and you just feel good about yourself. So have your medium, your long-term goals, and have your small wins, you know, where you can really feel great about yourself. I would also say two other things. I'd say embrace failure. That's massive. You know, it's okay to fail. You learn from, that's your best learning tool. And then I would say also celebrate success. So look back on all the things that you've done and really, really acknowledge them. Because sometimes I think we don't think about that.
We're busy moving on to the next thing, aren't we? Yeah, yeah.
And I guess one more thing I'd probably say is identify your team at you. So surround yourself with people who are going to help you be successful.
I love that you said that earlier. Yeah. I had never thought of that as a concept almost. But
I think everyone's got to have it, not just as an athlete or a young person. Yeah. Team you, you know, people who basically want to invest in making you better. So that could be your parents, that could be a teacher, a member of staff. Anyone who's basically willing to help you be successful.
Yeah, excellent. The podcast is called The Game Changers, so extraordinary, trailblazing women in sport. What do you feel your legacy will be looking for? You've mentioned this a little bit. Is it about your playing career, or do you feel, I feel I know the answer to this now, there's lots more to come in the future when you look back in the future?
Yeah, I'm hoping it's going to be the next chapter, really.
Excellent.
I think what's quite interesting now, people don't see me as a rugby player. Mm. They see me as an influential leader, which is what I want to be. You know, I played rugby. I was really good at it. I tackled really hard. I think that's what people generally think of me when they think of my sport. And I think that's awesome. But now I need to start paving the way for another impact on the world. And I like to think that is being that leader who's creating change to an extent, but also having an impact on other people's lives. Like, I want to make sure that I can hopefully help others and them be successful, them exceed what I've achieved. And I'm not just saying for women and girls, I mean boys and men. You know, one of the young people who still stays strong to me in my life is a guy called Wayne Instrell, and I had an impact on him when I was a mentor working for the Youth Sport Trust, and now he goes out and delivers talks about the change in his life.
Wow.
And he's impacting many others.
It's like that ripple effect if you've impacted one and then...
That's exactly... And that's what I want life to be. I want people to exceed me. I want people to achieve more than what I've achieved because they were inspired by what I did. So rugby was a great part of my life. It's a chapter that I sort of have to close because otherwise you keep looking back, you know.
Yeah.
And now I'm thinking about my next path and I'm currently studying. I'm doing an MBA in... it's basically called an MBA for CEOs in sporting organisations. So it's around leadership.
Where is that? Where are you?
It's at the University of Salford.
Yeah, fantastic.
So I'm hoping to complete that, and that's building my skills and my repertoire of tools, I guess, to be able to fit into a position, hopefully, in the future.
What a truly inspiring human being Maggie is. So passionate about her sport, generous with her advice and time, and astute about the impact she could make in the future. There's no question that she will be a hugely influential leader. I'd love to hear what you think about the Game Changers podcast, so please do leave a review or give us a rating. It makes a huge difference and will help us to spread the stories of these amazing women in sport. To make sure you don't miss out on future episodes, please subscribe to the Game Changers
And you can find out more about all of my guests at promotepr.com/gamechangers. In the next episode, you'll hear from the hockey superstar, Kate Richardson-Walsh, OBE. With a record 375 caps for her country, Kate was England and GB captain for 13 years, culminating in that incredible hockey Olympic gold in Rio in 2016. It's a fascinating conversation where Kate talks very candidly about the highs and lows in her incredible career and her future plans.
It was being dropped, I think, gave me a bit of a wake-up call to say, actually, I'm so upset about this. I'm so embarrassed and angry, and actually, why am I feeling so emotional about it? Well, I actually care.